Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. That was Andy Offit Irwin, you just heard, a singer, songwriter, symphonic whistler, all around wonderful human being who has given us permission. That's not why he's a wonderful human being, because he gave us permission. He's a wonderful human being anyway, but he did give us permission to use that song as our opening. Welcome back to the radio.
Thank you.
That's not Andy, that's Stosh.
Stosh Ziolkowski, your co-host, and he's also a great storyteller.
He is also a great storyteller.
That is, Andy is a great storyteller.
Oh, I thought you meant... Whoa, okay, we might by the end of the show get on the same wavelength.
I'm not sure.
We need some practice. You've been gone a while.
I have been gone a while. This feels almost like the first time.
Today is Monday, October 1st. Woohoo!
Rabbit, rabbit, rabbit.
From Philip Roth?
No, from the first day of the month, if you wake up and say rabbit, 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 or in England, they say white rabbit. It helps. It's supposed to bring you good luck for the month.
Hmm.
So every first day of every month, I post on Facebook, rabbit, rabbit, rabbit.
I've seen that and wondered what the heck that was. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for explaining that. We had very different childhoods, you and I.
Oh, well, I learned this as an adult.
Oh, some of us are still having our childhoods.
I think that applies.
Okay.
To both of us.
Would you like to talk about the Speak Story series, Stosh, as your first?
I don't have my. Well, yes, I can. I think, and if I make a mistake, I think you'll correct me.
Maybe.
Coming up a week from tomorrow is
Linda Gorham.
And Linda will be performing at Shepherd University for the Speak Story series.
October 9th.
And a guaranteed wonderful evening. On November 13th, Megan Wells will be performing. And both of these will be at Shepherd University, part of the Speak Story series. And then in December, Elizabeth Ellis will be back. Her performance was snowed out earlier this year. She was the first storyteller in line this year, and unfortunately she was snowed out. But on December 11th, and we're kind of keeping our fingers crossed that there won't be a snowstorm, Elizabeth will be back, and she will be actually doing storytelling on December 11th, and she will also be doing a workshop for anyone who wants to attend. You can check on that at www.speakstories.com. And there is a fee for the workshop, but it's for anyone who would like to learn how to tell personal stories. And so that's the lineup coming up. And I have heard that next year's lineup is even more wonderful than this year, if that's possible.
But we're not going to hear about that for quite some time yet,
no.
I think. And Adam indicated he was nowhere near ready to share that information. Okay. Our theme today, we forgot to tell our listeners that, our theme today is scary stories.
Scary stories.
It being the 1st of October. Mm. And I think we both have a couple stories to share. Would you like to start us off?
I will. And I'm going to be using today, at least one and maybe two stories from that a friend of mine has written. She is not a storyteller, but she is a writer, and she's been published, and I have been given her permission to use a couple of her stories. And this is one of my favorites. I've performed it a number of times at festivals, in Halloween gatherings. So this is A Fisherman's Tale by Laura Lovick Lindsay. The summer's fishing had not been kind to Brander, nor the spring prior to that. Finna herself was hungrier than ever, her swollen belly pushing the table every time she set. Another child was on the way. Brander hoped for a seventh boy and made what sparse offerings he could afford to the gods in that hope. But as of late, the gods seemed to have turned their backs on him. Brander picked his way up the path between the cliffs that lined the waters, careful not to catch his shoes on the rock on the thick sea-sprayed mosses that flavored these rocks. He trudged the hill homeward, empty. Nothing to take to market. The other men of the village steered their boats to the far part of the harbor, closer to market. It was easier that way, their nets straining to contain their haul. Only a short year before, Brander would have been among them, choking and unloading, while the youngest boys of the village raced to be the first to help bring the catch ashore. But these days, he found he was no longer welcome among the men. His bad luck might be catching. They became quiet and elbowed one another when he passed. All laughter and joking stopped when he walked near. Silence but for winds and water. Instead, village hands busied themselves stretching forth nets to be repaired before putting out again to sea before the next dawn. The eyes of those too old to fish looked down at their table work as they cut open the catch, gutting and cleaning, to dry some of the day's bounty to put by for winter. Sparse wisps of smoke drifted from the chimney of Brander's lone cottage and its place upon the cliffs. Unlike those two close cottages in the village, clustered and almost huddled together for warmth from the winter winds that would begin very soon. The chimney smells reached him now, bringing forth the scent of seaweed soup for yet one more night. Their own supply of dried fish had run out in the early part of the spring. He came in as quietly as he could, but the boys saw him and ran to his side, the older ones helping him off with his coat, the younger ones pleading the dreaded question, "How many fish today, Father?" To this he gave no answer, but continued to pull off his boots, rubbing his feet. The older boys, glaring, punched their brothers who dared to ask that question. Finna squatted at the fire, stirring, scooping, and handing bowls. She smiled at Brander all the way to her eyes and handed him the largest steaming bowl. He noted every day there was more seaweed and less from their tiny garden. But the coming winter sea could not continue to be generous. Brander's face grayed over at this thought. He turned away from Finna that night in bed, ashamed to face her. Turned his face instead toward the wall that sided the sea. Finna reached over and stroked his hair, kissed the back of his neck. "I will go tomorrow and see wise Ingfrid. She will tell us how to restore your luck." Brander was quiet. He did not wish to be in debt to a witch. His whisper held great reluctance. "You know we cannot pay her." Finna shrugged, untroubled. "She will pay herself. We will give her half the fish she helps you to bring in." The following evening, as he walked through his door, Finna caught his eye with a small nod and a tight, nervous smile. There was much to do. She sent the boys to collect wood for the night's fire while she whispered hoarse to him over soup, drawing with her finger on the table. The next morning, Brander awoke much earlier than usual, picked his way carefully to the beach, sliding down sometimes in his haste to begin his morning's work. He readied his boat and made as though to leave it, but then paused and looked around. Surely it was time. He walked the strand of the beach, picking up many small rocks and piling them near his boat. The pile grew as an hour passed, then 2 hours. Finally, he had enough. he began placing them in the sand, almost in full circles around an empty center. Some of these curves he connected with others, some he left alone, uncompleted. When Brander's work was finished, he stood up back and had the thought that what he had created looked rather like the ripples of waves that came forth when a stone was tossed into the sea on a fair weather day. Following Ingfrid's careful instructions, he now entered his labyrinth slowly, giving the fae that were plaguing him time to follow. When he reached the center, he paused just a moment, then jumped as far as he could outside his many circles and ran for his waiting boat. He pushed off, paddling as hard and fast as he could, the sea heavy on his oars. Hopeful, he knew the fae could not cross or leap the lines of the labyrinth as could he. It might take them hours to work their way out. Brander paddled until he was so far from shore that even the cliffs of home would no longer be seen. Brander walked quickly up the hill to home late, late that night, laughing sometimes as he slipped the mosses. It had taken extra time to row toward market and unload. So full was his boat of fish of all kinds. He had stopped in the village to let some of the men buy him drinks. It had taken longer than he had thought. He rejoiced in the many coins in his pocket, the more that were coming. He had just crested the hill when a figure emerged from their cottage. A few steps closer and he recognized Ingfrid, carrying a small wrapped bundle. She turned in his direction, wrapped her shawl tighter around the bundle. She faced him, defiant, then spun towards her home beyond the village and stalked away. Brander stood, watched her for many minutes, then went inside where six boys were already sleeping. He climbed into the bed next to the now empty, weeping Finna, stroked her hair, and kissed the back of her neck. Seated before her fire in her own cottage, Ingfrid drew the child nearer to her. Few questions would be asked by people in the village. They remembered well what had happened to those who had dared to question Ingfrid before. The child slept, sated for now by goat's milk. A seventh son. It had been an easy enough process, leading the fae to Brander the previous spring. She felt no pangs of conscience. It was the best possible outcome for all concerned. Who better than she justified herself, to bring up a seventh son? She would know how best to further his abilities. He would never starve in her cottage. He would know and even play with his brothers. Secrets weren't easily kept in a small village. And as for Brander and Finna, well, it certainly wouldn't be long before they added an eighth, ninth, and tenth child to their home. Ingfrid thought she might even slip Finna some herbs to speed the process along. The child stirred slightly. She picked him up, holding him in the firelight, and began to sing.
Wow.
Fisherman's Tale. That's one of my favorite stories to tell at near Halloween.
Yeah, I can see why.
About 4 years ago in Pittsburgh at the Three Rivers Storytelling Festival, I told that story in concert with a dancer who performed a dance around me on stage while I told the story. And that performance grew into an actual Halloween performance on Halloween in a small theater with a total of five dancers, all choreographed to that story. And it was one of the hits of the evening. I actually told six stories that night, being surrounded by dancers each time, which was quite an experience.
That really adds to all the mystery and imagining all that movement around you.
one of the first things I liked about where you have stories in the round is that on the grounds there is a labyrinth.
Yes. And a lot of people use that labyrinth.
I know. I've never walked it yet.
Well, you're going to have to do that.
I have to do that.
There will be. That's your homework.
I don't want any of the fays to follow me.
Well, I was going to say, and think about that story as you're walking the labyrinth. You're listening to the Enlightened Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. We are community-based, internet-structured storytelling hour and radio program. And that was Stasz Silkowski telling the story of
The Fisherman's Tale.
I'm your co-host, Fanny Crawford, and I am ecstatic to have Stasz back on the air with us. It's a lot more fun when you're here, Stasz. Did you know that?
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I have a lot of fun when we do this, and I really disliked having to miss so many weeks, but I'm in better shape now. I can actually walk a lot better.
Well, and you have two new hips.
Two new hips.
This is pretty exciting all by itself.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to talk for a minute or two about stories in the round.
Okay.
If that's okay, is a good time. Stories in the Round, of course, is the storytelling series that I coordinate in Hagerstown. I had never said any yet today that we're broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia.
And now you did?
And now I just did. Okay. I may say that again later on because it seems important. But Stories in the Round is headquartered in Hagerstown, Maryland, at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 13245 Searfoss Pike. You may know that road as Route 58, State Route 58, or even as Salem Avenue extended at the west end of town. And coming up on October 22nd, we have Anne Thomas returning to us. I think this is the second time she's been with Stories in the Round. And if you don't know Anne, you definitely want to become acquainted. She was a National Storytelling Festival Slam champion a couple of years ago. She's been featured on The Moth with StoryCorps and Risk. She's been in the New York Times. Is co-author of a couple books, Sucker for Love and Roar, that she did with Jessica Piscatelli Robinson. All of those books are, both of those books are available online. And in her former life, not too long ago, she was a civil rights attorney, conflict resolution expert, and a leadership development innovator. And through all that, she's been a storyteller, but now she's telling stories lots more. You can find out more about her by going to annbthomas.com, which is her website. Anne has an E on the end. annbthomas.com. And if you want more information about Stories in the Round, you can email me at fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y at hotmail.com, or you can call me at 301-730-1638. And I can tell you how to get tickets in advance for Stories in the Round, because if you do that, you'll get a little bit of a discount. Tickets are $10 in advance, $12 at the door. And included in that are even snacks. We have volunteers who bring the most delicious snacks.
Very delicious snacks.
Every time. And you'll get to hear Anne Thomas. In November, this is the first time this has been publicly announced, Stasz and I are doing another two-person play for Stories in the Round, and that date is November 26th.
Yes.
We're usually the fourth Monday of the month, and both October and November are. It's only in December when Christmas interferes, the holidays interfere, that we'll have third Monday of the month. But would you like to tell the audience about The Guys?
The Guys is a play written, actually it was written about two and a half weeks after 9/11. And It is a play, two-person play, about a fire captain who has been asked to do eulogies for some of his men who were missing in the towers on 9/11. And he's at his wit's end to know exactly what to say that would be proper and correct at memorial services for these men. And so he winds up spending time with a writer who assures him that she will help him to write the eulogies so that he can pay tribute to these men, so that they get a final going away, which pleases their people, their families, and pays tribute to them in a good way. So it's a two-person play. It's very serious. There is some there are some funny lines in it, and I think it's a wonderful play because it doesn't talk about the terrible things that took place in the towers or the politics involved. What it talks about is the bravery of workers, firemen, policemen, and others who save lives and very often don't get any credit for it in the correct way. And it also allows for people to reminisce and understand the consequences of some terrible tragedy like 9/11 and how it affects not only the country, but especially the families of those who are lost.
Well, I'm looking forward to that performance.
And I am too.
We still have a lot of rehearsing to do, but we're getting there. Thank you, Stosh.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm going to do a story. And this is actually part one of a two-part story, but some of our listeners have heard me portray my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes. And when I do that, I use his voice. So this is a story from his writing that I have not so far incorporated into the performances that I do on stage. And so this is an experiment to see how this works as a scary story or a story about scary things from a child's perspective. And I guess I should say that we've been working with Kevin Cordy, whose specialty as a storyteller is playing with story and using play to improve your story and look at your stories in different ways. And so I'm using some of Kevin's advice as I work on this story. And if you're listening and you want to provide some feedback, I'd be happy to have that. I already gave my phone number once, but I'll give it again, 301-730-1638. Not while we're on the air, that's my cell phone number, but I'd be interested to hear from any of our listeners. Okay, so this is a story from my great-grandfather in his voice.
My name is Thomas Henry Barnes. T.H., my family sometimes calls me now that I'm elderly, 93 years old now in this year of our Lord, 1942. At my age, I enjoy the flattery. Now, possibly some in our radio audience have heard me tell stories of my childhood, how my parents died young in Lewistown, Pennsylvania, father first, and then 3 years later, my mother, in 1861, when I was but 11 years old. When I tell the story of my mother's death, Jane Williams Barnes, I often say that was the saddest day of my life. And I talk about the sound of the funeral my Uncle Peter, my mother's brother, came from Brooklyn to Lewistown and conducted the funeral. And my most painful and vivid memory is the sound of the clods of earth hitting that coffin, that hollow, loud, shocking sound. And I'm just glad that other children, orphans, no longer have to listen to that sound, as it's not often a part of funerals these days. Well, it was then after the funeral that Uncle Peter took me home with him to Brooklyn. Now, Brooklyn was not as developed as it is today. Farms, mostly. Not many villages. A school or two. But they were meant for white children. And no school in all of Brooklyn would accept a dark-skinned lad like me. Uncle Peter and Aunt Caroline were determined to do right by me. Across the East River in Manhattan, Uncle Peter's great friend, Dr. McCune Smith, a well-educated colored man from medical school, from a school in Scotland. He was American, but he had been educated across the sea and was now director of public health for New York City and the presiding physician for a respected and well-endowed school founded by two Quaker women 30 years earlier for the shelter, care, and education of freeborn colored children. By the time I was enrolled, the New York Colored Orphans Asylum succored 300 boys and girls in a three-story, finely equipped building over a full New York City square block between 43rd and 44th Streets along Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. Now, Uncle Peter and Aunt Caroline enrolled me as a half-orphan, meaning they gave $1.50 per week for my room, board, and education, thus securing the right to bring me home with them whenever they wished. Uncle and Aunt did often come for me by carriage, taking me off to their home place. I was well cared for, both in their Brooklyn household and at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, receiving a fine academic education, schooled in moral rectitude and the social graces. Mathematics, the literature, the history, music, I learned, was far finer than any enhancement I might have absorbed from the tiny tumble-down Lewistown colored school. Well, there's much to tell about those years on Fifth Avenue at 44th Street. Another time, perhaps, for my story today will focus on my leaving that place, my final summer with the institution. I was ill that winter and spring, partly the result of the loss of our beloved building at 44th. And Fifth Avenue, in a terrible fire. You may have heard me tell that story. I speak of that terrible week in 1863 frequently, as I'm often asked to tell the story of the burning of the New York Colored Orphans Asylum. Now, not a single child was lost in that fire, in spite of the great danger. All 300 of us, with our caregivers and faculty, had temporary shelter, but eventually removed to a dilapidated mansion on high ground above the Hudson River. The wooded estate where the mansion stood was park-like, with ancient orchards, berry briars, paths leading to hidden grottos and down to the Hudson. But the paths and trees were overgrown, rotten, covered with weeds, underbrush and decay. Ponds with no outlet nor maintenance were rank with moldering vegetation and filled with diseased germs. Everywhere was wilderness, infested with snakes, frogs, swamp creatures, the usual denizens of stagnant pools and swamps. There was adequate and excellent fresh water from a spring that ran down the hillside to a large copper water tank, 100-barrel capacity, and operated by a hydraulic ram, as well as adequate rainwater from the roof directed to a cistern for laundry and household use. Now, the house itself was in a terrible state of neglect when we arrived. The third floor consisted of many small rooms, servant quarters, all connected by a back stairway. In the attic apartment were storerooms furnished with rows and rows of hooks, shelves, and old wood storage bins. The basement was a confusing labyrinth for housing tools, utensils, firewood, ice, laundry, kitchenware, food storage. There were no outbuildings except a barn, which was constructed on the same sort of elaborate plan, but was meant for horses, cows, and poultry, with spacious carriage rooms and a coachman's quarters. All of the buildings were of wood, now failing and nearly destroyed. They yet stood, but much flooring, roof, and underparts were rotten, fallen in, and moss covered. The 20 or more years that this grand residence had not been opened above the basement made it a dangerous place for the health of children. Our managers, for weeks before we came, tried to air out and renovate, but it was poison, foul with gases from decay, a veritable pest house. What a place for 300 youngsters. We went wild, missing our old home at 44th and 5th Avenue, and in rebellion from the close confinement of our three-month temporary quarters on Blackwell Island in the East River, where rigid rules prevailed. These new wilds on the palisades of 152nd Street were too much for us. Our managers busy each day trying to get this place, this home, in convenient shape and tasked as well with building a schoolhouse left us without restraint. With those acres of wilderness to traverse, the effect was soon felt as the season advanced toward winter. Rain, wind, and storms transformed our outdoor adventures into unhealthy, life-threatening escapades. And soon enough, our new home served double duty as the infirmary and hospital. What a time we had that winter. Every variety of sickness the human family could contract. Inflammation of the eyes was an epidemic, along with whooping cough, 76 coughing at one time. Excuse me. The memories with me still. Bowel trouble, poison ivy, typhoid fever, throat infections, and everything else. And why not? We drank the water from those stagnant pools, ate the bad as well as good fruit, and waded in the marshes and swamps. always very healthy. I was first taken with sore eyes, then whooping cough, and finally typhoid fever. I was put in a room with seven others, five of whom soon expired. There were 12 deaths that winter. Miss Dr. McCune Smith, with an assistant, was our physician, but so overworked that his health failed him. Dr. Frothingham succeeded him, a fine old man, though it was kill or cure with him, rough and gruff fellow. One night he took my temperature and pulse, and rising from the bed and wiping his instruments, he spoke to the nurse, Mrs. Titus. "Well, Thomas can't live. At the turn of the night, 12 o'clock, he will die." I was perfectly conscious, could hear and see, but I could not speak or move, and had no pain. The doctor said I would die, and I suppose he knew, but I had not the slightest idea of such a thing. I wanted to tell Mrs. Titus that I was thirsty and wanted something to eat, but I could not speak. I watched the clock, looking for the time to come. At 12 drew near, I saw Mrs. Titus's anxious looks and actions. She brought in Mrs. Carter, another nurse. Together they bathed my head with cool water and put a large spoonful of orange juice in my mouth. It went down, but I could not swallow. It felt and tasted so good. Mrs. Titus was a favorite of mine, loving me as her own son, as she watched, holding my wrist for hours to monitor my pulse. I saw the tears in her eyes, but I could not speak. I tried so hard to tell her that I was not dying. I wanted her to kiss me and give me plenty of orange juice, but she didn't either, only watched me. I lay there, fighting off a death with that willpower. All I had. 12 o'clock came, and there they stood over me, all attention. "If he could only speak," they would say. I tried my best to call out. The morning came, then in the doctor. The boy next to me had died. The doctor sat on my bed, examined me, and then, looking over at the dead child, said, too good on earth to stay. And looking at me, he said, too bad from earth to take away. Tom here will live. Mrs. Titus asked, her voice strained, "Doctor, do you really think Thomas will live and be well again?" Dr. Frothingham answered, "Yes, you can't kill him." I certainly owe my life to Mrs. Titus. She gave me efficient, constant, and devoted care. Pardon me. After 3 months, I came out of the hospital perfectly well, but weak and emaciated. The winter had been very severe, cold and snowy, with a salutary effect in removing germs and disease, and spring brought health, sanitary conditions, and healing sunshine.
Wow. For a second there, I was afraid you caught something from him.
Ah,
that is scary.
That was my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes, telling a bit of a story about his scariest time in the New York Colored, well, one of the scariest times in the New York Colored Orphans Asylum.
I can't imagine what that would have been like to lie in bed and not be able to speak and hear a doctor say, well, he's going to die. At
any minute.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Wow. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour in broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. And this is Stasi Olkowski, your co-host, and
Fanny Crawford, your other co-host.
And if you want to look up some or listen to some older tales and tales that you can hear at any time at your leisure, you could go to talltales.enlightenradio.org, and there are a number of podcasts with the radio broadcast there. And you
2 years worth of podcasts.
2 years of tales that will delight you.
We hope.
And maybe frighten you.
Okay. Do you have another story you want to share before I do the other part of this?
Yes,
one?
I do.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, before you do that, since we were just talking with T.H. Barnes, I should tell our audience that I will be portraying T.H. Barnes on October 20th in Frederick, Maryland, at a house concert, Susan Gordon's house. And she has space for, I think, something like 35, 40 people in there. But it's filling up. Mm-hmm. October 20th, 6 p.m. for refreshments and getting your little hors d'oeuvres together. And you're welcome to bring a snack if you're so inclined. And then 7 p.m. storytelling starts right on the dot, so you don't want to be late for that. And if you want tickets to hear T.H. Barnes tell his life story, it's an hour performance, and then you get to question T.H. Barnes and ask him whatever has occurred to you while you're listening. And then you get to question Fanny Crawford also. So give me a call at 301-730-1638 if you want more information about T.H. Barnes' performance on October 20th in Frederick, Maryland.
I'm looking forward to that.
Me too.
Yes. So I have a short story. Again, another story written by Laura Lovick Lindsay. And this one is, the title of this is Festival. The end of winter festival blazes in the village below us as I open my cabin door. I am up here in the hills. There is much to see. I shiver and wrap my cloak about me and move silently behind trees to watch people prepare the day. Bonfires as tall as men decorate the landscape. It is early, still, but the villagers huddle before them, bartering, exchanging what remains of their meager autumn harvest. No wafting scents of roasted meats reach me this festival. No laughter, no uproar of music and celebration. Three men finger wooden whistles. There are only a few who pretend to dance steps. At the center stands a thick pole. There is a man bound to this by his ankles, by his middle, by his arms, by his neck. He has been beaten, flayed beyond recognition to lie in pain a full day before they dragged him out to his death. Some say he didn't live that long, but ceremony would be followed. Every villager lays a bundle of sticks at his feet. They spit in his blood-crusted face. Riddance to you, John Haberman, and a curse upon your bones. Superstitious fools. John Haberman has done nothing wrong. He has not harmed these people, has not stolen their livestock. His crime was to have had too large a harvest in a village where having plenty is viewed with suspicion. Burn, came the verdict. He has seduced the gods of harvest. He has found favor with them, neighbors had accused. He has been given our shame. He has been given our share of bounty. What I have is also yours, John Haberman protested, his words trembling, though I knew his body did not. He believed the people would see reason. But the people had stopped listening, and John Haberman was mistaken. Village men began whispering on their boats, on their hunting excursions. Village women whispered as they gleaned their meager gardens, collected laundry from lines. Before Elder Smith had arrived from the city and pronounced sentence, the village had long decided this man's fate. Elder Smith had John Haberman bound and held for festival night. His hands were burned. His children were sent back to his dead wife's village. They would be seen no more. Elder Smith left the leaders of the village to carry out his instructions. The coward would bear no blood on his own hands. I returned from 2 weeks foraging to find John Haberman's fate ordained. I am grateful to be mostly ignored here in my hill home. I load my sled, tie it to my own waist. When there is hauling to do, I must do it myself. My cattle, too, were taken to fill bellies in the village. But I am fast and I am strong. I bless the snow. Without it, this journey would be impossible. On snow, I can pull. In mud, I'd stand no chance. Wind is fluting through the trees. Every twig plays a different angry note. It slices through my cloak and kirtle. It knots the hair. I forgot to tie back in my haste. New snow slaps my cheeks like an angry mother. 1 mile, I can no longer smell the festival wood fires. 2 miles, there are no more footprints along the mountain paths. 3 miles, I am trudging slower. I cannot breathe this ice air much longer. 4 miles, if the snow holds, this may be far enough. I uncord my load and choose my spot as winter thunder echoes among the hills. I brace myself against an oak and use my legs to push it off the sled down the hill. My burden rolls 5 times before coming to a stop against 2 trees. It is the best I can do. I pack snow around it. I need to hurry back before his fires are lit. I reach my cabin as a kind of frenzy takes hold of the village. Every man, woman, and child is throwing hate at the pole, at this man, this offering. I grab my prepared torch, race down the path, praying they will not start without me. There is plenty of time. I light my torch and stand among them, seething, waiting the signal. When it is given, I make sure my torch is the first on the pile. I stand among them an hour, making certain consumption will occur. It is good you have decided to join us, Greta. Old Jasper Twining is staring at me. Many of us wonder about you up there alone in your cabin. I break my gaze from his leering eyes. My work is done for now. It is time to return home. I take my rest in the cabin for 1 more night. Before dawn, I bind my last few items to the sled. It is good I do not have much. I pat my cabin door on my way out. I have seen much from this cabin, but few have seen me. I say a prayer to thank the evergreens for their sure cover. My feet find the path I followed yesterday. As I pass the 4 mile mark, I look down to the clump of trees where I packed snow to hug and hold him when I could not. I toss near him the blood-stained leather flail I had used to exact whatever revenge was possible. Small consolation. The wind blows, still cuts into me like a dagger, but I am warm, remembering the fire and the smell of the flesh of Elder Smith.
Oh. A woman's revenge.
Yes. I've never performed that. I've never done that from stage.
But you should.
But I would like a chance to do that. But it's a very subtle tale in the sense of the... You have to have the audience's attention so that they understand that there was a switch made.
Yeah.
And I like it very much. Laura Lovick Lindsay has a devious and satanic mind, which I approve of.
Wow. Okay, well, you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. And I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Ziolkowski.
And we are telling scary stories today. And I'm going to see if I can fit in a reduced version of the second story, reduced in the sense that to get to the important parts, I'm going to leave some of the out. So this is T.H. Barnes, my great-grandfather, telling his story, pieces of his life story. By springtime, the management of the New York Colored Orphans Asylum had completed a long, roomy wooden building for school purposes. Conditions were now wonderfully improved, and health was returning to the student body. I returned to school. The institution had received 3 scholarships to Oberlin College, a gift of that college from the year before. And in the contest for selection of the candidates, I took first position. But the doctor advised that I was not yet well enough to go and insisted I wait till the following year when I would be stronger. This was a great relief to me, for I began to anticipate that I would be homesick in Ohio and was in no great rush to get there. Miss Anna Shotwell, the original co-founder of the New York Colored Orphans Asylum and School, a revered member of the Society of Friends, and now the principal director of both the school and home, determined to nurse me back to health that I might represent the school with honor at Oberlin. She packed me off to spend the summer at her country home in the village of West Farms. About the 1st of June, 1864, with an extra suit of clothes and the envy of all the boys, I entered the lady's carriage in company with her, the 10 miles to her farm in Westchester County. It was a beautiful summer morning. We started early with a lunch basket, driving slowly over dusty roads. We made several stops, and she wished to call on friends along the way. We arrived at her home in the late afternoon with lengthening shadows, pulling up before a large, antiquated colonial farmhouse, 3 stories high, with huge pillars and dormer windows on the slanting roof. We were met on the steps and pleasantly welcomed by a young colored woman whose name was Nancy, the housekeeper. Nancy quickly prepared supper for us, cold-boiled ham, bread, butter, cheese, currant preserves, and hot tea. And when dark came, Nancy showed me my room and my bed. Up the stairs to the attic or top floor, Miss Anna Shotwell, Nancy Smith, and myself, Tommy Barnes, were the sole occupants of that great big old farmhouse. The attic had been prepared for me, a great spacious garret over the whole house, about 8 feet high in the center, sloping to about 4 feet on the sides, with 6 large dormer windows, 2 on each side and 1 on each end, looking out over the roof. The floor was bare except where the bed stood, and there was a strip of carpet on each side. The bedstead was old and old-fashioned, with great round posts, head and footboard, corded to hold the straw-filled mattress. It had 2 sheets, all scrupulously neat and clean, a light quilt and a feather pillow. There was a small old table, candlestick, candle and matchbox, quaint chair. Around the room, several cabinets, clothes, presses. On the walls, innumerable shelves of books and pegs hanging full of clothing for men and women. Great coats,
heavy dresses, gray, brown, drab. Massive oaken chests with great iron locks and hinges. Old trunks, antique furniture. All hung and arranged in painful order. No dirt, no dust, no clutter. Everything in fine repair, but oh, so grim, so quiet. My bed looked like a great white field. And as it was growing darker, I lit the candle. But oh my, it cast great shadows that frightened me. I blew out the light. The twilight through those draped windows cast great figures around the floor, such deathly stillness, and there I was, alone in that great garret room, afraid to lie down, afraid to stay up. I looked toward the stairway, thinking of flight, but it looked deep and dark. So I dropped to my knees beside the chair and prayed, as I had never before or since. Stealthily, I looked to the windows and then all round the room. Rising to my feet, I stood looking in every direction of the fearful silence. And a few lines from Edgar Allan Poe's famous poem, The Raven, came to me, an accurate summary of my position and emotions. Deep into that darkness, peering long, I lay there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams I never dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word. Well, with me, there was no word spoken and no echo, but I remember the sound of my own voice whispering, "Mother." Then turning back to the high bed, I climbed into one corner, the full expanse large enough, the bed for a dozen my size. With my senses all alert, I lay there thinking of the past long winter, of my illness, of how so many of my fellows had died, 5 of the 7 in my room. Now I was well and growing strong. I deliberately closed my eyes and thanked God for my life, my relatives and friends who had been so good to me. And then the thought came, unbidden, why should I worry? Fear left me, and I lay there and peacefully fell asleep. My mother, nearly corporeal in her presence at my bedside. The details of that night are as vivid as that night 60 years ago and more. Dear friends, have it as you may. I firmly believe it. It was she, my mother's influence, that took the fear from me in that great attic room. I never was afraid after that. A cold sense of security came over me. When I told Miss Annie that next morning of my thoughts and the night I passed, she was visibly affected, though she struggled to compose her face. At prayers, she prayed that God would assist her to make me happy and contented.
Wow.
Thank you, Stosh.
Yeah. That's creepy.
I want to work on it some more. I think it needs maybe some more humor, and it needs a little bit of scariness at some further points. So I'm going to play with that some more with Kevin Cordy's advice and see what happens.
The idea of his mother calming things was freaky to me.
Yeah, I think she was that kind of influence on him all his life.
Well,
it's time
to close the show, Fanny. So,
if you say so.
I think time says so. All right, this is Stasi Olkowski and
Fanny Crawford
closing out today's noontime broadcast of the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. independent community radio from Bolivar, West Virginia. Tune in next Monday at 12 noon for more stories. Light and Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window in the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all our stories. Join us next week, same time, same place, for more storytelling. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
A Bob Dylan Odyssey.
A Bob Dylan Odyssey. Wow.
Bye-bye.
So long. Mm-hmm.